Now to this, a raft of new privacy laws come into force today to better protect New Zealanders and their information. Under the Privacy Act 2020, businesses and organisations must handle personal information more carefully, and the Privacy Commissioner now has greater power to ensure they're following the rules. So key changes will include, for example, reporting immediately to the Office of the Commissioner and affected individuals as soon as a privacy breach that may cause serious harm has occurred. New criminal offences that can result in a fine of up to 10 grand for misleading individuals to access information or destroying information while knowing it has a request for access. Professor Gahan Gunasekara is the chair of the Privacy Foundation. Professor Gunasekara, kia ora.
Yeah, good afternoon.
What do these changes mean?
Well, I think it's going to be a step change for New Zealanders, but in the end, the Act is still very similar to the legislation we are familiar with. It's principles-based. There are still information principles. There's now 13 instead of 12. So there's a few tweaks, like overseas transfers of data now have additional requirements. But I think the point you made in your opening was that if organizations lose data now or they suffer a breach, then they need to, as soon as practicable, they need to let people who they think might be affected by that know. And that's a difficult, that's going to be a difficult assessment for many agencies to judge, is this going to be serious enough that we need to tell people that we've lost their data? They need to think, you know, what kind of harm is going to happen otherwise?
Yeah. So when the Privacy Act first became law in 1993, we didn't live a huge part of our lives online, did we? The societal shift has just been massive, hasn't it? Have our privacy laws kept pace, or were they really outdated?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, I think what has changed in the almost three decades is that now people are far more aware of the value of their personal data. And I think that's the biggest factor. The public are now far better informed. And we've had a regime in New Zealand which, you know, was pretty groundbreaking at the time. At the time, you know, people looked at New Zealand and said, what a leader. You know, we're actually leading. We have one of the first countries to have a information privacy law. Some countries still don't. The United States, for example, still doesn't have a comprehensive law.
Really?
So you know, we led the world, but of course, you know, the rest of the world has moved on, and now we're at the point where we're struggling to catch up. And this law, while it's welcome, it's still not anywhere near as much protection as the new European regulation, for example. But it's still good. I mean, it's still worth having these changes.
Okay, give me one example that a concrete example that might be faced by a business or a company.
Well, the $64 million question is, let's say you have a hack or something like that. And first of all, you've got to identify, was anything taken to start off with? I mean, if nothing's been taken. But often that's a difficult assessment to make. You don't know. You've suffered a hack. Your IT people say, you know, it's going to take us a while to go through this and figure out what the threat actually is. In the meantime, do you need to, if the data is potentially very sensitive, like it's got health information, for example, maybe financial details, maybe credit card details. Should you then, as a preventive measure, immediately go and tell all your customers, look, we've suffered some kind of attack. We don't know how serious, but just be careful in how you manage your credit card. Keep an eye on it. But then some people might, if you get too many of those kinds of warnings, people will just switch off and they'll think, oh, this is another one of these false alarms. So it's about when to cry wolf, and I think that's going to be very difficult. Those of us who are lawyers understand the kind of standard involved here, and it's a standard that lawyers understand because we look at reasonableness of harm and reasonable foreseeability and things like that, which lawyers are actually quite good at analyzing. But the layperson doesn't sort of automatically have those kind of skill sets to be able to assess, is this the kind of harm that, you know, how downstream can I foresee? Who's going to suffer the harm? And you shouldn't have to foresee harm to the nth degree because, you know, it's impossible to foresee every eventuality. There could be some remote possibility that because individual X loses their data, that affects Y, which affects A or B down the road. I mean, that's going to be too far-fetched, I think.
Hey, just a quick response to this, and we'll leave it there. Exceptions to whom this Act doesn't apply, members of Parliament.
Yeah, so unfortunately, they are still exempt. And now there may be constitutional reasons for that, because obviously what's said in Parliament, you know, cannot be questioned, of course, in any... I mean, that's the old... the constitution we've inherited from Britain, Bill of Rights and so on, the 1688, which means, you know, you can't question things that were said in Parliament. So if someone discloses someone's personal information on the floor of Parliament... but I would question whether that may be okay for the floor of Parliament, but what MPs do in their offices, you know, I would argue that maybe that should be covered by the Privacy Act. So this is something members of the public yeah. made submissions on, and unfortunately the politicians haven't been brave enough to kind of embrace it.
Well, watch the space. Professor Gahan Gunasekara, the chair of the Privacy Foundation, thank you very much for that. Just a quick response to that. And Tom, when it comes to privacy, how much do you guard your privacy?
When
it comes to social media, for example.
Yeah, I'm on a bit of a pendulum. I sort of swing back and forth. Sometimes I kind of feel like, oh, there's no hope. You're a bit hopeless, you know, that you're probably listening to everything I say now. And I mean, there have been times where I've said something to a friend and my phone's popped on, like Siri's popped on and tried to answer me. And I'm kind of going, I'm not even talking to you. But yet you're listening, you know. And so I think sometimes you feel a little bit hopeless and you kind of go, oh, it's just, there's nothing I can do about it. Everyone's watching. And then sometimes I kind of swing back the other way and go, right, I'm turning my phone off, I'm, you know, putting on my tinfoil hat and no one's going to know anything that I'm thinking. Any, you know, so, look, I don't know, I swing on a pendulum, to be honest, Wallace.
Yeah, what about you, Catherine?
Yeah, I feel much the same, really. Like, I think it's, I've had some of those warnings, you know, and also there's so many scammy warnings, so the scammy versions of
yeah.
those warnings. So I've kind of given up, I have to say. And I think, you know, if someone wants to listen in on what I'm up to, well, you know, it must be a slow day at the office, is what I'm saying. It's pretty dull.
It's amazing to think how, just reminded me back then, talking about that in the last, I mean, the Privacy Act first became law in 1993. Gosh. Were we even texting in 1993? Can you recall?
What were we doing?
We weren't?
No, emailing.
We were emailing
yep.
in 93?
Yep, surfing, I'm sure.
Gosh.
We were.
Gosh, extraordinary, isn't it?
Mm, incredible. I like telling young people, when I was growing up, we didn't have the internet. I love telling young people that.
Just a little bit of feedback here across the topics. We were trying to get hold of our snake man, but I don't think he is picking up at the moment. But if he doesn't, we'll try and get hold of him tomorrow. Scotch eggs. Page 97, Edmund's Cookbook, says Willie of Waipokoro. In 1983, I arrived at a boarding school in Wellington from Hong Kong. I was horrified by Scotch egg and beef olives. Unimaginably disgusting, but the alternative was no dinner. Di says, regarding a lot of response regarding small business and sick leave. We're a small business. We increased sick leave as soon as the pandemic started. If we caught COVID, bye-bye business. We're too small to survive an outbreak, so 10 days made sense to us. Another one here is, who are you kidding? I employ young men in my arborist business. They are often off even without sick leave to use, says this person. This is this person's view. But a lot of people actually supporting what you say, Anton, about having that really good relationship between employer and employee. And there has been a couple of examples in the paper recently, and one in Christchurch, where you haven't had that good relationship. But if you have that honest relationship, it goes a long way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I've worked with people, and I mean, you know, even if you think back to your school days, there were some that were, you know, keen, you know, would always stay at home calling in sick or not coming into school because they were sick, and you actually knew that they were just pulling a sickie. So this is not a new phenomenon. And I've worked with lots of people and I've employed staff that sort of take the mickey from time to time. I think over the years, you look to try and hire people that, you know, you think have integrity, and then you do your best to look after them. And I think that's probably the key to not just...